Welcome, readers one and all, to episode 119 of the Nerd Extravaganza podcast, a podcast whose spotlight finds talent no matter where it resides. I'm Tom.
I'm Brian.
And tonight we're happy to shine our spotlight on Brian Downs, a man of many talents, not least of which is his writing ability. But before we start our interview with Brian, let's steal the spotlight for ourselves for a moment with our Geekly Weekly, Weekly Geekly Roundup. Brian, why don't you go first, man? What have you been up to?
I have done two things this week, and one of them was a horrible, horrible mistake. I always talk about how susceptible I am to, if you don't want to call it addiction, fine, but online obsession. So I've been playing Path of Exile pretty much every spare second of my life for the last week and a half. Going to need to kick that habit eventually.
I demoed that very briefly. I tried it, and it seemed pretty cool. It reminded me a lot of like the maybe Diablo or Diablo 2.
Yeah, I think what made me want to play the game in the first place was how much I did not like Diablo 3, because I really like that type of game. But I don't know, Diablo 3 did not deliver on the experience I wanted, and Path of Exiles kind of is. And things are sufficiently different that I don't even mind replaying it, because I've had to start like three or four characters now, just, you know, trying different things out and playing the hardcore leagues, and then when you die, your character is done, so had to start over and stuff like that. Don't even mind that.
Is there, I mean, it's online, right? I mean, are you playing with other people, or can you team up with other people, or how does that work?
I think a party is six people.
Okay.
And a lot of the content is soloable, but you'll need to grind a little bit because, you know, it's kind of hard. But I've been playing with our oft-mentioned buddy Lester, and the two of us do pretty well. We get through most of it.
Oh, cool. I'll have to join you guys. It'd be a chance to hang out. I haven't seen Lester in a while, in real life or virtually, so maybe I will join in. I did try the game. It seemed kind of cool. Maybe I will join in.
It's a lot of fun multiplayer, too. I think that really makes it, like, it's a tiny bit on the slow side when you're trying to slog through on your own. It's much more fun in a party, as long as they're not asshats.
Cool. Anything else?
Very briefly, I have pulled myself away from that to play a game that I have no idea how I got. You delivered this to me. I don't know how you were introduced to it or anything like that. A very fun kind of action shoot 'em up game, Assault Android Cactus.
Yeah. Yeah. Little story behind that. Yeah.
I played five or six levels of that. It's enjoyable. I need to get a controller. I think that would help it a little bit more. But I like it. I like the different characters. Cool game. And I'm excited to hear the story.
Okay, cool. I will get to that because now it is time for my update. Before I get into the main body of my update, which is PAX, 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 because I went to PAX this past weekend, I should point out that I received a prize in the mail. I received a prize from a contest I won for a podcast I like called the Press Continue podcast. I did all sorts of social media exercises, and as an achievement, I won this prize. So I will be taking a photo of that prize, posting it up on our Facebook, etc., and submitting a photo to them as well. So check out the Press Continue podcast. They're a cool little gaming podcast that recently started. You can check them out on Podbean. I'm pretty sure they're on iTunes. I've mainly listened to them straight on their Podbean site, but they're pretty cool, and I wanted to get that out there before I got into PAX, which is the next portion of my update. All right, lots going on at PAX. I'm going to go through a rapid fire. I will reserve the right to revisit some things I forgot during later updates, but I will rapid fire through some of the stuff. First off, I should say, I went by myself this time. Last year I was with a hardcore video gamer friend of mine. Not that I'm not a hardcore video gamer, but that was his sole kind of purpose for being there. So we didn't touch tabletop at all last year. Well, this year it was just me, which meant standing in line for the video games for a long time was a lot less entertaining because I had no one to talk to. I could play my 3DS games to a certain extent, but that only got me so far. So I got spent a lot more time with tabletop. Nevertheless, though, I did check out some video games, and here are some of them. I played a game called Castle Crashers, which is put out by the Behemoth. Pretty cool. They had like an arcade stand up for that. It's a console game, but they had it set up in this cool arcade cabinet, four player. Really cool. It's been out for a while. I don't think it's new, but pretty neat. Played the Kingdom Hearts Remix on the PlayStation 3. I guess the second Remix Collection that's coming through. I've started playing the first one, so it's, I guess, Kingdom Hearts 2 Remix or whatever. Pretty cool. Anyway, it's amazing how much of an upgrade there was between Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2, considering they both came out on the PlayStation 2. Played Dragon Quest 8 on, of all things, a tablet. Now, Dragon Quest 8 was that really great Dragon Quest game for the PlayStation 2. Now plays super smoothly on a tablet, and I never would have thought I'd live to see that day. That just tells you how much power there is in these handheld tablets compared to consoles of yesteryear. Played Sonic Boom, a Sonic game on the Wii U. Pretty solid. Didn't mind it. It's funny, I always try these Sonic games, and I say I'm going to get them, and I never get around to it. I may pick this one up. It seemed all right. I played another game on the Wii U called Swords and Soldiers 2, which was sort of a two-dimensional, real-time strategy-ish kind of game. I didn't know that there was a Swords and Soldiers 1. I must have missed it. But Part 2 seemed pretty cool, kind of Viking-y. And, of course, played the blockbuster hit Hyrule Warriors on the Wii U, which should be coming out, I think, later this month. It is a Dynasty Warriors-esque game set in the Zelda universe. And that alone makes it worth buying, as far as I'm concerned. There were a bunch of other games for the Wii U, Bayonetta, that I wanted to try. I couldn't get near them. I gotta say, there was a lot of, like, the blockbuster stuff out there, like the really big, huge blockbuster games. 2 hour lines, man. And I don't know about you, but, like, by myself, I won't wait 2 hours at Disney World. So, I mean, I don't know. What do you think? Am I wrong? Is 2 hours worth it to wait for a video game?
No, man. No. I've always, just the concept of standing in line for more than, like, 20, 30 minutes bothers me.
Right. I did it for Hyrule Warriors. I was in line for, like, an hour for Hyrule Warriors. It was worth it. But I'm not going to wait, like, 2 hours for it. Nothing's worth 2 hours. You know, if you're with a group of friends and you're having a good time, that's different. But I just didn't have it in me. And not when there was tabletop stuff to check out. But before I get over to the tabletop side, I should also mention I played some more video game stuff. For PC, I played PlanetSide 2. That was kind of cool. Like a shooter slash RPG, I guess, mixed together is what PlanetSide's all about. Got kind of that impression. It's a known series, but I'm confess my ignorance. I played, quote-unquote, Landmark. I know we've talked about this in the past. It used to be called EverQuest Next Landmark or whatever. Now it's just Landmark. And the reason it's called that, Brian, is, and this is a direct quote from the rep at the booth, not everyone wants to play high fantasy. I knew you would appreciate that. So I guess the, like, Dick Rocket Ships have their not high fantasy place, and they recognize that. So it's now a standalone product simply called Landmark, and it's not necessarily tied into the EverQuest high fantasy intellectual property slash franchise. So does that make you feel a little better about things at all?
It makes me feel a little bit better about that particular game. It makes me feel much worse about EverQuest Next, which I don't think is ever going to happen.
Oh, really? I mean, but I thought the whole point of this Landmark game was for them to gain a lot of technical expertise.
Well, the technical expertise and the promotion for their title, which they're now disjointing from it, so...
Oh, yeah. I mean, the guy was pretty... He sold me. I'm still on board with the vision. He's like, you know, we're learning from this game as people play it, so it's great. I'm like, okay, cool. That's what I thought. He's like, we just kind of separated it from EverQuest because, you know, not everybody's keeping with the high fantasy theme. I'm kind of okay. I think there was kind of a little nerd veto that went down, and we're like, no, this is high fantasy. We're not allowing this to have the EverQuest name if we're not going to enforce that. So they just called it Landmark.
Or they realize that no one's playing high fantasy, so they're just, you know, going to make another game that they can use the knowledge they get from Landmark.
How about they make that other game and then make EverQuest for us? How's that?
Sure.
Anyway, big takeaway. That's the second PAX in a row I had a really great experience at the EverQuest booth. I don't know what it is. I see the EverQuest stuff and I just get so nostalgic, and I spend so much time talking to the reps, and they actually appreciate that I appreciate EverQuest. I don't think, in our minds, EverQuest is this huge, like, epoch-defining game, and I don't think in the minds of most people it is, because you could walk up and, like, talk to those guys, no problem, but the booth to play the new World of Warcraft expansion or Hearthstone was another 2 hour wait. That's just kind of how the cookie crumbles as far as people's perceptions and where things are in the marketplace. I can't see standing in line to play an expansion for an MMORPG, and I certainly can't see standing in line to play a card game. But I guess that's just me. Not trying to criticize other people's PAX choices.
It is not just you.
Okay, good. It's you and I. Let's see. Apart from that, again, as I mentioned, crazy long lines. I did, however, snag a couple of Steam download codes for only $5. It's normally a $15 game for Assault Android Cactus. Their booth was there. They were very enthusiastic. Hey, try our game. Try our game. I tried it. Four guys and I played it with controllers. We do need to get controllers, I think. And it's just chaotic fun. You're these little chibi characters, and you're just blowing stuff up. Just a fun multiplayer game. I think it's up to... We played four players. I think that's the max. And it was pretty cool. So I would like to play that with you. So we'll have to get ourselves some PC controllers and maybe enlist other people. And as I mentioned, and I'll mention it one more time, lots of Blockbuster stuff. You couldn't get near it. I don't know what PAX can do about those lines, but I'll just be spending more time in tabletop if they're going to be like this in the future. Which brings me to tabletop. I spent a lot of time with Japanime Games. I went back there like multiple times. So if I don't mention a lot of things, please understand that that really doesn't matter because I spent quality and quantity? I don't know. I may not have hit a lot of games, but I spent a lot of time. I played Crossmaster. I played Tanto Kuori? I don't know, the little kind of pervy anime game. And I played Kansume Goddess, which was also really cool. I don't know if you've ever played that, Brian. It's kind of like a Greek, Roman, etc. pantheon, drawn in like cool anime style. Had a great time with that.
I really wanted to play that game, and I actually went to purchase it and had it in my hands. It comes in like this kind of like weird collector's tin.
Yes.
And I was so enraged that it wouldn't fit neatly on my shelf. I didn't buy it. I never got around to it. What's wrong with a box, guys?
Well, the actual owner of the company, the guy who runs the company, was telling me, yeah, I'm, you know, when I brought the game in, this was the deal. It came in this can, and once you sleeve it, your cards no longer fit in the can, so the can becomes like an accessory. But he seemed to be more focused on Crossmaster and the Tanto game, and Kansume Goddess has sort of gotten in third place, which is a shame. The girl that demoed it for me was really enthusiastic. She's like, you know, I really wish we would push this game. It's really good. And her enthusiasm might be why I had such a good time with it. Like, we had fun playing that game. And I would play that and or recommend it. So Kansume Goddess and any of the offerings from Japanime Games. Just cool guys overall. Oh, by the way, they had their big like tournament there, and the winner of that tournament won a giant size Crossmaster set, the giant size demo sized set. I've taken some pictures and shared through our social media outlets of me holding the one of the figures, and it just fits in your hand. Really cool. I almost wish they would sell that commercially, but it would probably cost a fortune. In addition, apart from Japanime Games, I got to play in a demo of Numenera, the pen and paper tabletop RPG that I've been expressing some interest in. Brian Dalrymple from AGS, who was on our previous episode, got me interested in that. I'm still interested in that, and playing it made me more interested in that. So I think I may pursue getting a campaign going there. I got to play Golem Arcana, the miniatures-based, like, tablet-enhanced game where you use the little scanner to scan things into the tablet. That was cool. And I played with the creator of and purchased a cool little card-based trivia game called Geek Out, kind of in the spirit of, well, really any trivia game where you read a question and the person has to answer. So that was it for my gaming. There's actually a lot more, but I summarized and I already took up way too much time in this update. And in addition, I will mention one more place. I got a card, and I'm going to go preview a cool little geek club for geek professionals, I think is what they termed it, called Verne and Wells. The name comes from Jules Verne and Orson, I think Orson Wells, or his father, H.G. Wells probably, right? Or grandfather. Wasn't it his grandfather, Brian?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, War of the Worlds, right?
H.G.
Yeah. So Verne and Wells, it's called, and it is kind of the club of our dreams, like the cool club, private hangout that we've always dreamed of, or so it seems. I will probably be visiting that in the coming weeks and report back on it. And that concludes round one of my PAX update. I again reserve the right to blab on about it in future episodes. But with all that out of the way, I think it's time for us to commence with this episode and welcome our guest, Brian Downs.
Okay, we are pleased to welcome tonight's guest, Brian Downs. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Welcome aboard.
And thank you, Brian. I'm glad to be here. Very excited.
Well, we're glad to have you. Brian, you came to know Nerdstravaganza, Brian, because you are both contributors to the Florida Geek Scene website. Do you do comic reviews like Nerdstravaganza Brian does?
I do a number of things. I have done some movie reviews. I covered the Conjure convention recently. And I've been writing a series on how to be a tabletop game master for Florida Geek Scene.
Oh, very cool. And how long have you been involved with them overall?
Well, only a few months. I think it's been 4 or 5 months now, but it's been quite a ride. I enjoy it very much.
That's cool. What about you, Nerdstravaganza, Brian? How long have you been working with Florida Geek Scene?
I got on after MegaCon, so since February, March.
Okay, so you're both on board a matter of months now. That's cool. So I'm curious, now you mentioned, we obviously want to get into your novel project, but before we do, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the Game Master advice you're writing. So you're doing a series of advice, that sort of thing about
A how-to series of articles, advice for tabletop game masters on how to be better at what they do. I've been a game master since I was, about 15. I'd been playing Dungeons & Dragons for a year or two when I started to see ads for Shadowrun when Man Meets Magic and Machine in Dragon Magazine, somewhere about 1989, and I decided that was interesting, and I started game mastering, and I've always been the sort of guy who had the organizational skills to make that happen. Every player is sure they could be a game master too, but actually the organization and the dedication necessary to make that happen every week is not as common as people think. So over the course of my career as a gamer, I've easily been the game master 90% of the time and a player 10% of the time, just because I was always the person who said, I have an idea for a campaign I'm putting together.
Yeah, that's interesting. As Nerdstravaganza Brian will attest, I was sort of a 90% game master / dungeon master back when we used to play. The challenge I found, and I think Nerdstravaganza Brian, you will back me up on this, is not so much with my organization skills as it is with the task of herding cats.
Oh, yes.
Those cats being the players. Like, hey, guys, let's get together once a week at an appointed time and let's play a game. Seems to be too tall an order for most people to fill.
Yes, very often. And that's one of the things that I'm going to be addressing in the series is ways to mitigate that problem. I see a lot of game masters, I feel, who are kind of reinventing the wheel. You know, I have a lot of experience in the hobby, and I want to be able to help them do better and not have to duplicate the same work I did. We live in a world now where you can go online and learn to do anything, right? Your toilet's not working right, or you're trying to install your router, or you're trying to change a tire, you can just Google a video for it. So why shouldn't there be essentially that resource for game masters? It is, in fact, a pretty demanding position, game master. I mean, everyone thinks, I could do that. And I've seen a lot of players over the years try to be game masters and quit after about 3 weeks.
I hate game mastering, for the record.
Well, it's good that you understand that about yourself. Stick to what you enjoy.
Couldn't agree more. And I think in my absence, all right, I'll tell a little personal story. We were getting into the Star Wars Edge of the Empire tabletop role-playing system for a little while, and I was GMing us through sort of just a starter module for that. And, man, like right away, all of the interpersonal conflicts and everything involved were just too much. So I quite wisely, in retrospect, bowed out. But, Brian, you stayed there when a new person decided to try his hand at GMing. I mean, he did not have a great time, right?
That was a rough group. First off, it was huge. I think there were like 14 of us one night. We had four newbies, one couple that didn't want to play so much as make out in front of a group of people they didn't know. And the DM was just like, well, no one else wants to DM, so I'll do it for the very first time ever. And he put in a really noble effort, but...
Yes. Well, so did Custer.
Exactly, with a not satisfactory result at the end.
Yeah. Where the hell are all these Indians coming from?
Right. So, I mean, assuming you can somehow get a group of players that are on board and committed to playing, then, of course, there are the, I guess, tremendous logistical challenges of well, I don't want to say logistical, but let's say creative challenges involved in coming up with a campaign and a narrative and sort of steering the ship of play, right, as you go along?
Oh, yeah. Well, many challenges like that. But one thing I said in a recent article is that one important trick is to get your players to do a lot of that for you. And how you do that is by playing to them. You know, when you're putting together a group, I'll use Dungeons & Dragons, of course, as the well-known system. Everyone knows the reference. You know, if you have a ranger in the party, then make sure to offer them some wilderness stuff to do. Make sure to give them chances to track things, you know, to sneak through the woods. This is what they were imagining during character creation, right? You get a ranger with high tracking and high stealth. They wanted to sneak through the woods tracking monsters. So make sure to give them those encounters. At the same time, if you have a bard in the party with a lot of social skills, make sure to give them opportunities to exercise those social skills. Try to imagine what they were imagining in character creation and then give it to them. Too often I've seen game masters who come up with the campaign without considering their players at all. So they might say, well, okay, you're a ranger, but we're in the city most of the time. Now, if you want to do an urban campaign, then you should sit down with the player ahead of time and say, okay, I don't recommend the ranger because it's not really going to fit into the campaign I have envisioned. But the players will carry a lot of the weight for you if you just respond to them. I ran a vampire campaign a couple of years ago that I set in occupied Paris, in part because I'd done all this research for the novel that we're going to discuss later in the interview. And one of my players was himself a graduate student, and his Tremere, a vampire, had a cover story that he was a professor at the university, at the Sorbonne in Paris. So I made sure to offer him subplots where he could use and abuse graduate students, because that's what he wanted to do. You know, he was himself a career academic at an entry level as a graduate student, and he wanted to sort of wish fulfill some ideas of what if I was a professor and secretly a vampire. So I invented whole subplots to feed to him because that's what he was looking for and that's what he enjoyed playing. Too often, game masters just kind of railroad players along their idea. You know, well, I've decided that this campaign is going to be like this and you guys are coming along for the ride. And that's a way to disengage your players. When you're playing to them and offering them, you know, what they came to the table for, then they'll get very excited. You know, so what does he do? He starts ghouling his graduate assistants and plotting against other members of the faculty, you know, and then this gives me new things to play off of. So when it comes to plotting, you can really let the players carry a lot of that if you'll just work with them.
So it sounds like a campaign would benefit a lot from the GM sitting down and talking to the players about sort of their background and not just the stats, but yeah, tell me about your character. Give me a biography. Where are you from? What are your aspirations? That sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Also, when it comes to plotting, too often it's very easy to just wind up with the bold adventurers who emerge from the mist and are interested in treasure, basically. But I encourage game masters to encourage their players to think of being involved in something bigger. You know, perhaps they are, you know, members of the King's Guard and get sent on special missions and they're all loyal to the kingdom. And then this gives you a dramatic through line. I mean, you take a look at one of the most important things, really, for game masters is to take television as your model. Too often, game masters look to movies, but movies only last for 2 hours. It's much better to look to Game of Thrones or Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Breaking Bad, because that is what you want. You want an ongoing series of episodes that link into each other where people want to come back next week to see what happens next. And that kind of drama is produced by people having loyalties, by people having motivations, not just, I like bopping monsters on the head and taking their treasure, but, you know, I'm defending the kingdom from the orc barbarians or something like that. I mean, what would Game of Thrones be without the various characters' loyalties to their individual houses? I mean, that provides 90% of the drama that drives the show.
Yeah, I think, and Brian, maybe you can back me up on this, I think there's a certain type of player who is sort of a power gaming achievement amassing type that wants to gather all the sweet gear and treasure and kill monsters. As a player, I've never been that way. I'm more interested in my role in the unfolding story, Nerdtravaganza, Brian, I think you were more or less the same mind when it comes to play.
Yeah, and I've had some, I don't know, power gamers, rules lawyers, whatever you want to call them, just completely ruin evenings, too.
The Hydra.
I was gaming with another large group. There were probably seven or eight of us, and seven or eight of us minus one wanted to do this amazing role-playing, you know, do this and do this. And we were making an ocean voyage when a Hydra attacked. And everybody was like, you have to get the people to safety, and you have to make sure that he doesn't interfere with the crew, and you have to do... And one of our guys was just like, I have a feat that makes my spells unresistible once a day. I put him to sleep, and then I coup de grace. It's like, you just kill the Hydra, but that...
Yes, well...
All right, well, we'll call it an evening.
Well, you can't blame him. You know, when he has those tools at his disposal and you're attacked by a monster and the idea is fight the monster. But yeah, that kind of thing can happen. I feel that's more of a fault, though, in the game design than necessarily the player.
That you was know? Not my favorite system, for sure.
Mm. What system was that?
D&D 4th.
Oh, yeah. D&D 4th is fascinating to me. D&D 4th comes out, is a massive, tragic mistake on the face of it immediately. I mean, you have the flagship sword and sorcery role-playing game of the universe, and you absolutely remodel it so it's all but unrecognizable, and make it look like an MMORPG, which is ridiculous, because if I wanted to play an MMORPG, and many people do, they would go to their computer and play one. You don't sit at the table with the dice in your hand because you want to play Warcraft.
Or you do. I'm going to defend this jerky player that knocked out the Hydra. As soon as his timer filled up and he could once again click that ability, he used it and killed the Hydra. I mean,
well, right, exactly. But that was the problem with 4th, is that if lots of people do want to play MMOs, but there are plenty of MMOs to play. People who sit down with dice at a table, you know, with pen and paper, want to play a pen and paper role playing game. You know, so they had a very well-recognized property. They had a built-in audience, and then they go and essentially, you know, throw it away by changing the product unrecognizably, which leads, of course, to the emergence of Pathfinder, which is essentially D&D 3.7.5, which has been tremendously popular. Although I have to admit I'm not a big fan of Pathfinder. I've always felt that it was too complicated. But now Wizards of the Coast, having realized their fatal groupthink, are coming out with Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition, and I've been looking at the player's handbook for that, and I'm writing a review of it, and I'm deeply impressed with what I see. I think it's very elegantly designed with a great simplicity of play. I mean, playing Pathfinder, I typically have six different equations on my sheet just for how my fighter can swing his sword. Am I using power attack with power attack and with this and with that, then I'm getting plus 7 to hit and 1d8 plus whatever. Dungeons & Dragons 5 so far, I think, has a great simplicity to it, but still the kind of complexity that will attract tabletop gamers who don't want to play checkers, obviously. That's why they're playing Dungeons & Dragons.
I welcome some complexity in play and some strategic thinking. Mm-hmm. I don't welcome... let me set the bar really low to please me in 5th edition. During my first combat encounter... Mm-hmm. If I swing my sword at an enemy, if I'm a melee character of some sort, as long as I'm not yelled at for not using Holy Strike instead, we're off to a good start.
Yeah, I'm very impressed. One of the things that has always annoyed me about Pathfinder and even D&D 3.5 before that is that it's not really a sword and sorcery game. By fifth level, it's a superhero game. If I play sword and sorcery, I want to go into the dark woods with a sharp stick. You know, I want to be armed with a spear and have light conditions be a problem and so on. Where Pathfinder by fifth level, you know, you're cranking out fireballs and fighters are hammering out damage like the Terminator. It's really become a superhero game, which is a different genre altogether.
Yeah, gone is the sort of sense of tension. You know, you could be wiped out by whatever foe might emerge from behind the next boulder, that sort of thing, right?
Right, right. And you wind up very quickly fighting, you know, dragons by the pair or trio or demigods or major devils. It's really a superhero game, but pretends to be sword and sorcery. so far with what I've seen of 5th edition from Wizards of the Coast, I think it really keeps that sword and sorcery feel much longer up the level progression.
Is most of your tabletop role-playing fantasy then? Are you into sci-fi at all or any other settings?
Shadowrun's been my favorite, far and away. Yeah, I've been playing Shadowrun. It is, I love and hate Shadowrun as I love and hate myself, but it is precious to me. I have keenly watched each new edition over the years.
I'm going to introduce a third Brian into the mix. Nerdtravaganza Brian, did not AGS Brian mention last time we had him on a new Shadowrun release?
I think 5th just came out.
5th edition is just about a year old now. So it's relatively new, yeah. And they just released the Street Grimoire, I think is their most recent release, yeah.
As I recall now, I think what it was is we had our guest on recently, and he was at, was it, which show was it at? It, basically, Shadowrun had won an award. And
that
that's
was
why
Gamma, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So apparently it was very well received.
Yeah, they've had strong sales with 5th edition, and I haven't had a chance to play 5th edition Shadowrun yet, I have to admit. After 5th edition came out, I did run a 4th edition campaign, only because I had so much material for 4th edition that I've been playing 4th edition for years, and I had dozens of books and so many, you know, NPCs generated and all this kind of thing, that I thought, well, I'll wait for 5th edition to mature a little bit. But there are a lot of things I'm impressed with in Shadowrun 5th edition. I do think that they solved a lot of problems that the system suffered with before. And, of course, they've caused themselves some new problems, but that's always the nature of a new edition. So, but I'm excited to give it a try.
Any thoughts of or have you heard of a game called Numenera?
You know, I've heard the name, but other than that, no. I'm not familiar with it.
I had the opportunity to check that out. I went to PAX up here in Seattle, the gaming convention, this past weekend, and I got to run a little demo of that. Pretty cool. Cool kind of way distant several apocalypse. Several apocalyptic? I don't know how to say that. The world's been remade quite a few times, and that's the setting. And pretty cool simplified combat system. So I'll just throw that out there as a recommendation if you're looking for yet another system to try out. I am going to press Nerdtravaganza Brian and other friends into playing that. I might even be the GM. My God.
Well, always excited to hear about new products and, you know, the hobby moving forward. When it comes to game design, my basic rule of thumb is this. When you're designing a rule, can you imagine anyone saying, you know what I love about Shadowrun 4th edition? I love that it requires 7 different die rolls over the course of 2 game weeks for me to buy a rifle. No one is saying that. That's not going to happen. Reviewers are not going to be saying, that's what's great about this system. Nobody's saying about Pathfinder, you know what I love about this system is that it's really almost impossible without a spreadsheet to figure out how many spells you have per day and how many you've used up. And what your meta magic feats allow you to do. No. How can you possibly imagine that that's what people are saying? This is what's fun about this game, is the vast amount of bookkeeping involved in my sorcery. So I think that game designers should keep that question in mind when they're designing. Are people going to think this is fun when they're doing it?
Yeah, good point. And I'm sure for some people, they love the complexity. I would guess for the average person, there's a balance to be struck somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And if I do decide to get things going with Numenera, I look forward to consulting your series of advice columns at Florida Geek Scene.
I think you absolutely should, because it is the best series of Game Master advice, well, probably really in the history, maybe since the ancient Egyptian civilization.
I think they found some early edition role-playing hieroglyphics on the in the basement of some pharaoh's mom's house, so... Yours is probably better.
I hope so. I would hate to think, oh, gee, I came too late.
It's never too late. It's never too late. Okay, so in addition to your Game Master advice, you also do some reviews for Florida Geek Scene, is that right?
Yes, I've reviewed the Shadowrun 5th edition expansions and 5th edition itself. I've also, actually come to think of it, done a number of interviews with Central Florida artists, painters, and other artists who, well, actually come to think of it, just painters so far, who do nerdy things in their work. For example, I interviewed an artist named Parker Sketch, who does a lot of paintings of Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, classic video game characters. I interviewed a painter named Cade Michaels, who does a series of horror portraits, the Golden Girls with their skulls exposed, this kind of thing. So, you know, I'm always excited to be able to bring public attention to area people who are involved in nerdness and producing material for it.
That's cool. I mean, from having spoken to Michael, I think one of the founders of Florida Geek Scene, I believe he's one of the partners. Is that correct? Michael Favada? Is that his name?
Well, actually, I haven't encountered anybody named that, but that doesn't mean that's not true. I have always used Scott Schlazer as my contact person at Florida Geek Scene.
Nerdtravaganza, Brian, keep me honest about Michael.
I've talked to Michael like once or twice, but yeah, I usually deal with Scott too.
Okay, well, I don't know what the hierarchy is. I've spoken to Michael, but regardless...
I know he exists.
Yeah, he exists, and he's involved in some capacity. But regardless, I think that the spirit of Florida Geek Scene is, as the name implies, to sort of highlight the geek scene in Florida. And it sounds like through your interviews and reaching out to local artists, you're doing that. Mm-hmm. I want to make a suggestion. Nerdtravaganza Brian is something of a geeky artist himself. He is an excellent figure painter and actually painted me up a really sweet army, Legion of Everblight, for the Horde's tabletop gaming system in order to get me to play as a birthday present. So I think he should do a regular series on figure painting, and I want you to encourage him to do that.
Well, I think that would be great. I think that more tabletop gaming is exactly what Florida Geek Scene needs. We have lots of comic book coverage, movie reviews. That's great, of course. But the website really aspires to cover every aspect of being a 30-year-old virgin. So, no, I mean, seriously, we'd probably love to have a series about figure painting. Have to check with Scott Schlazer, though, my boss. But he's generally very go for it, is his attitude. So we should definitely see about that.
Author on it by him.
Yeah, do that. Now, you know, I'm really kind of curious as to whether or not I might have started a Florida Geek Scene war and not knowing the hierarchy over there. Might have to do a little editing of this episode. We'll see.
I'm sure it'll probably work out just fine.
I suspect it will. So far, this interview is working out quite fine. Nerdtravaganza, Brian, anything else to ask on the topics of Geek Scene or reviews before we move on?
No. Nothing I can think of.
All right. I guess that gets me to...
We've all agreed that we acknowledge the existence of Michael.
We may not be. We may be taking that out.
There is somebody named Michael who may or may not make the cut in this episode, but who swore was my contact at Geek Scene.
You can contact him at Schrodinger's Michael at Florida Geek Scene.
Now we have to keep it in.
If he's observed, he exists. Right, so... Boy, I hope I got that right. Schrodinger's cat. Yeah, I think that's right. Anyway, let's move on to your writing, sir. Move on to, and I know I got this right, The Berlin Fraternity. Tell us all about it.
Well, The Berlin Fraternity is a novel written by myself. It's available on Amazon.com, also the Kindle, and I'll be appearing at Spooky Empire this October as a vendor, as well as at Winter Garden Wonder Fest in November. It is the third novel I've completed, and it is about a man named Emmett Tinyanov, who in about 1917 is recruited into an ancient, secret, government-backed vampire hunting organization in Berlin when he is a young man. He's in his late teens. He's like 17 or 18 years old. And the book follows him through the next several decades of his career as a vampire hunter, through the end of World War I and then the collapse of the German government and the Great Depression, when he tries to keep the organization going on a shoestring budget and a very small staff. And then after the rise of the Nazis, his group gets wrapped up in Hitler's government and he winds up as an SS officer who hunts vampires for Hitler. So it's a sweeping historical epic, dark fantasy historical epic.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the historical aspects. Now, in the excerpts that I was reading, I was kind of struck by the amount of historical detail, like to the point where I was pausing to go Google certain things about the First World War. Mm-hmm. Are you a student of history, or did you just do extensive research on World War I history and beyond?
Well, I find history a fascinating subject, and I think it's certainly true that people who ignore history are doomed to repeat it. But I don't have any formal training in the subject. I am a sophisticated gentleman of some experience, so I had a basic idea of the outline there. But I did do a good deal of reading and research about the period to write those scenes. I'm fortunate, of course, to live in the information age, where all sorts of things can be found online very easily. When I'm writing that, obviously it's set in a certain time period, and I want to be accurate, and I want to offer a vivid sense of place. You know, what would it be like to be in the trenches at the Somme front? But at the same time, I don't want to just turn it into a history lecture. So that's something I work hard to balance. I don't want it to just become Brian talks about history because history is interesting. So that research and that detail always has to support the narrative. But sometimes I find I have to explain things like in the first chapter, Tinyanov is at the Somme front in 1917. And I want to explain how the German army came to be parked in France. So I devote a paragraph or two to that, the progress of the war so far. But I don't want to turn people off with too much on that subject. But I'm always encouraged in reading the work of Neil Stephenson, who feels that no amount of research is too much and still sells a lot of books. So I feel I'm coming in under that benchmark.
I think you did a pretty good job of giving just enough historical details so that I felt like the book was written by somebody who knew what they were talking about as far as the period. Brian, Nerd Travaganza, Brian, do you agree? I felt that the historical setting was very well presented.
Yeah, I thought it was atmospheric, but not like studious.
Mm. Wonderful. Great. I'm glad to hear it because that's exactly what I'm aiming for. And so I'm always gratified when readers tell me that that's the effect it had. Not to give too much away, but of course, in the first chapter, Tinyanov is in the trenches and he encounters a 30-year-old corporal named Adolf Hitler, who at that time is nobody. And Hitler returns as a supporting character later. Of course, he winds up as Tinyanov's boss. So I went and I looked at Adolf Hitler to get an idea of how he would talk and how to portray him. And that was very difficult because Hitler was absolutely stone cold crazy from day one. So when you try to write Hitler in the way he actually spoke, you know, based on records of what he said to people in casual conversations or on his public speeches or on his writings, he sounds like a Monty Python sketch about Adolf Hitler. I mean, he was nuts. It's kind of amazing that anybody would follow this guy to the bathroom. I mean, from very early, you know, hanging out with fellow soldiers during World War I, he would be saying things like, you know, well, the Jew is a parasite on Germany and we ought to throw them all in jail just for being Jewish. And I mean, just 100% nutball. So I was concerned in writing him that it would come off like I was trying to be funny, but I'm not. I mean, that's just how he spoke. I had to actually tone Hitler down a little bit.
Yeah, well, there's a scene in the first chapter that we were reading. Again, I'm not trying to give too much away, where you do a good job of conveying the fact that he's crazy, yet captivating, meaning that he goes off on a tangent, sort of just or a tirade, let's say, but he kind of draws your interest as he sucks you into his weird point of view, which I guess was his gift and how he was able to get so many people to follow his crazy plans.
Yeah, well, one of the things actually about Adolf Hitler, people often say, well, how was it that he did this? But I think that people don't appreciate the breadth of Hitler's career as a politician. I mean, yes, absolutely. He's talking about, you know, Germany overall, let's go conquer Russia. But also when he first begins his political career in the 1930s, the Great Depression was going on. Germany had been especially hard hit during World War I. Everybody was broke. You know, these are people who can't keep sausage on the table to the end of the week. And Hitler comes along and says, well, let's do this and let's do this. And that's going to raise the employment rate. And it did. So jobs started to appear and the government was hiring. And now people who had nothing before have a nice new uniform and a strudel on the table and a new Volkswagen. And they're like, great, sounds great. And then in the late 30s, of course, the war starts and Germany rapidly conquers Poland and France. Whereas in World War I, huge lakes of blood had been spilled to conquer a few miles. You know, Hitler seems to wave his hand and entire countries fall under the sway of Germany. So he seemed like a demigod to these people. They had spent 20 years counting their pfennigs to make the groceries last. And then Hitler shows up and suddenly it's new building projects and jobs for everybody and a big old Christmas tree. It's really not until like 41, 42, that things start to go against Germany. But by then, the generation of young fighting men who, let's say, if you're 20 in 1942, then you've been hearing about Hitler since you were 10, and probably your dad has been telling you since you were 10 that Hitler's a great guy. You know, so you've grown up with the idea that Hitler is God. And in this way, he had a lot of successes. You know, people had jobs, people had money now, people didn't have this fear of starvation. And it's not until the war really turns against them, you know, fairly late into the process, that it's revealed that clearly this was a terrible idea all along. But by then, of course, it was too late.
Yeah, and you know, it's against that slowly unfolding historical backdrop. And I guess history does sort of unfold at such a slow pace that people don't see folly a lot of the times until you're several years down the wrong path. But it's against that backdrop that this supernatural story is told. And I'm kind of curious about how, amidst all the chaos and all the tumult that was the early to mid 20th century, all of this stuff plays out. You know, I mean, imagine you've got this sort of, I don't want to say meta, but you've got this core mission that your order was established centuries before to fulfill. And like a lot of institutions that last for hundreds or thousands of years, you have to stay true to yourself in spite of a changing geopolitical climate, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And Tinyanov is a very much dedicated vampire hunter. He always makes that his first priority, is to hunt and destroy vampires.
I wanted to ask you one more thing, and this is getting a little into the plot, but I think it's not giving too much away. You can stop me if you think it is.
Okay.
The actual fraternity, it's mentioned early on that they have bases or chapters in capitals all throughout Europe. Is that correct?
Yes.
Given that fact, are they in service to governments worldwide or particularly to Germany?
They have chapters in the major cities of the world, but those chapters are only loosely affiliated. They don't have a central authority. So, you know, for example, there's the book mentions that there's a fraternity chapter in London. But, you know, Tinyanov doesn't know anyone from the London chapter personally. And there is no, you know, central fraternity boss someplace who's handing down orders to the various chapters. So really the chapters act very much independently of each other. And then as the war progresses, well, first the Great Depression and then the war makes communication between them even more difficult. So throughout the book, the Berlin fraternity is an entity unto itself.
Okay, so it's a fraternal order, but definitely not something governed from some central authority. Now I get it.
Right.
Okay, so there's not like a vampire hunting Vatican like that. Oh, God, extravaganza, Brian. What was that movie where they had like, it was at the Vatican and there were like priests and imams and everything all gathered together to hunt vampires? Do you remember?
Was that Saint?
Oh, it was something really stupid like that. Yeah. Oh, God. But no, this sounds way better.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, I've been writing a long time. I mean, I started when I was a child, literally. And I've published a number of short stories and so on in online journals. I've done a fair number of Shadowrun fan fiction pieces, which I think a Google search ought to turn up. If you Google for, you know, Brian Downs Shadowrun short story. Or look on my Facebook page, my Brian Downs author Facebook page. And I had written a number of screenplays, plays, and so on. I got away from writing short stories a decade ago when I got into writing novels. And what I would do is I would write a book and then I would send it out to 100 or so agents and publishers and they would not want it. So then I would write another book and do it again. So it's only recently that I've gotten involved in self-publishing and promoting my work myself, which is quite a different path to take. So it's been an interesting experience. The way I got involved in Florida Geek Scene was I'd written the Berlin Fraternity and self-published it, and then said to myself, okay, well, I need to find ways to, you know, get mentioned on the internet and so forth. So I went looking for blogs that talked about geek stuff and found Florida Geek Scene, and it said, we're looking for contributors. And I thought, well, gee, that could be fun. Because I'd been thinking about writing a series of articles or a short book about how to be a game master and so on. So I contacted Scott Slazer and said, you know, I'd like to be a contributor. And he said, all right, well, you know, tell me about yourself. And I said, well, you can get my Vampire Hunter book on Amazon.com. And essentially he said, okay, you're in. So it's kind of surprising the amount of credibility having written a gigantic historical epic will give you among other nerds. I was pleasantly surprised by that.
Amazon still has that mystique. Like, it's a real, you know, you have to be a real author, like, immediately.
Yes. Yes, it does. Because it's true. And I am a real author of magnificent talent. So everyone should go to Amazon before the end of this podcast and look me up.
Yeah, we certainly encourage all of our listeners to immediately throw money at our guest, Brian Downs, and his...
Put it in my G-string.
Oh, you have in your literary G-string, is it?
Yes, my literary G-string, absolutely.
Your literal and literary G-string, you got it. No, we of course, thoroughly endorse G-string play with all of our guests. And... speaking of G-string play and stripping and therefore through some really circuitous route showbiz, I have it on good authority, specifically your authority, that you are involved in some way in the showbiz industry. Is that true?
Yes. Well, I'm very happy to announce that I am involved in the production of a feature-length independent film. At this point, the title is A Tale of Shadows, and I think that'll probably go on being the title, being made by a fellow named Craig Bowers, who is the genius behind the Steampunk Ghostly Tales web series, which you can find at steampunkghostlytales.com. And Craig has a kind of a fascinating story. He had been to film school earlier in life. Now he's a painter of seascapes, among other things, and a Central Florida nerd. But he was making this steampunk web series, and he was looking for sets, places to shoot episodes. And there's a 1925 mansion in Howie in the Hills, which is north of Orlando, which is currently owned by nobody knows who. It's complicated. It was in foreclosure and so on. But he went to the people who control the place at the moment and said, look, I'd love to shoot like a 10-minute episode here. But then he got to talking to them, and the Howie Mansion Restoration Project wants to restore the mansion and make it into a public space. So they got very excited for the idea and said, great, well, how about, you know, we provide you with some resources and you could make a film here, and any profits will go toward restoring this property and making it a public place. So he said, wonderful, I'd love to. So I had met him and found out about the project and was going to do an article for Florida Geek Scene. But I'm a writer and I have some theater experience. So I said, look, is there anything I can do for you? And he said, well, yeah. He says, I need to cast this character. I don't have an actor to play Lord Dunhaven. I think you'd be good for the role. So I said, sure, I'm in. How can one say no to Dunhaven? So then he said, well, here's the script. And I'd love to have any suggestions. So, I made some suggestions, and he was very enthusiastic about my suggestions and said, I'm going to give you a co-writing credit. So I said, brilliant, super sweet, awesome. So now I'm the, you know, co-writer and actor in A Tale of Shadows, which is shooting this month.
Awesome. So did you mention earlier an acting background? I mean, I didn't realize that you, in addition to everything else, you were also an actor.
Well, I've done some amateur acting. I lived in Vero Beach, Florida a few years ago, and I did a few plays there with their amateur company. I did some theater in high school, you know, that kind of thing. A very minor acting record.
It's a lot more major than my acting record, I can tell you. I took like a drama elective in 9th or 10th grade, and that was the extent of my career on the stage. Brian, Nerd Travaganza, Brian, do you have an acting career of which I am not aware?
I was a stagehand in drama class.
Now that's more my speed, maybe. Cool. So what's the status of this particular production? How far along is it, etc.?
Well, it's in production. Principal photography is starting this weekend. It's a fairly short shooting schedule, so it's going to be a real guns blazing kind of operation, and we'll see what comes out of it. But I'm very optimistic.
Is this going to be directed video or YouTube, or where can we see this?
I have to admit that I'm not entirely sure about distribution. I know that they wanted to premiere it at a party hosted by the Restoration Project, that was the idea, and then probably make it available online with the hopes of raising funds, you know, to restore the property, as I've said. So, you know, more on that as it becomes available.
Cool. I hope you will keep in touch. I actually kind of have a soft spot for historical restoration.
Yeah, well, it's a beautiful, beautiful home up there. 7,500 square feet, which is about three times the size of the average home today. And just a gorgeous piece of property that unfortunately has fallen into disrepair. So we really hope to be able to get it restored. That would just be terrific. And it's an exciting project to be involved in. When I went up there a couple of times to visit the set as he was doing preparatory work and laying out a shot list, it was just, you know, pith helmets and period automobiles and angry ponies all over the place. Really an experience.
That sounds like it'll be fun.
That's my ambition, is for it to be fun.
Yeah, it sounds like it is going to be. So, geez, I'm kind of impressed by the breadth of your work at this point.
Oh, wow.
And I'm kind of curious. Let's see. I'm going to approach this next set of questions from the perspective of somebody who would like to write. But now I have to approach it from the perspective of somebody who would like to write and act and write some more.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I will hit you with the, what advice would you give to somebody? Let's start with the writing, who has always wanted to write a novel, but feels like they can't get the motivation. Like what got you to sit down for the first time and just start hammering out words?
Well, I was an avid reader as a kid, and I still read quite a bit. And I got the idea that I could probably do that better than a lot of people I was reading. So I started writing things. And I keep saying that I'm going to memorize this quote by George Orwell, where he says, writing a book is a horrible, exhausting struggle, like a long bout with a terrible illness. And one would never attempt such a thing if one were not driven on by some demon one can neither understand nor resist. I'm paraphrasing. It just seems to be something I do. I tried to quit after I finished my last novel, but then I couldn't, and I started writing my current project, which is called Red Sleeper, which is set in the same universe as the Berlin Fraternity. But if you're going to write a novel, against my advice, the first thing is don't think about writing a novel. A novel is a gigantic, intricate project, and there's nobody there but you. You know, if you're involved in a film, there's cast, there's crew, there's people you're working with. If you're writing a novel, you're carrying that. That's you. So don't think about writing the novel. Think about this scene, this chapter, right? Think about doing your work for the day. I literally use a stopwatch when I write. People have a hard time concentrating for more than 20 minutes at a time, so I set a stopwatch for 20 minutes. You know, and then I'll write for a while, and then I'll go do the laundry, and then I'll come back and write some more. And I think about, okay, you know, what is the purpose of this scene? Where is this taking me? I'm going to do my work for the day. Because the Berlin Fraternity in hard copy runs on to more than 650 pages. It's this sprawling historical epic. If you're sitting down to write page one and you're thinking, okay, my goal is page 650, you're just going to be too discouraged. The same way that you can't go into earning a degree as a freshman saying, okay, my goal here is a master's degree. You need to think about, you know, this class, this week, this semester. Any large job is easier if you break it down into small goals. So that's my first piece of advice. My second piece of advice is know what you're doing. As I say, when I write, I'm thinking, where am I going in this scene? What am I doing here? Too often I hear from people who say, well, I was trying to write something, but I just never got anywhere with it. And I would say, well, what happened? And they would say, well, I came up with an idea for a man who is one of the first colonists on Mars, but he has a problem because maybe the government of the Mars colony is corrupt and is oppressing its citizens. I said, okay, and then what? And then they can't answer that question. So that's the wrong way to go. You know, they'll start off with something like, John Smith woke up to survey the red horizon one day on Mars. No, you can't do that. You have to plan out, you have to plot out, you have to have at least a strong idea of where this is going before you start your principal writing. You can't just start writing. You know, Shakespeare doesn't sit down and write, who goes, which is the first line of Hamlet, and then think to himself, well, that's a good question. Who does go? Maybe a man, maybe a woman, maybe a horse, You know, no, he knows what's happening. He knows it's that Hamlet's going to die in the end. You know, he knows there's going to be a ghost. He's worked all that out ahead of time. So you can't start writing by just sitting down and saying John Smith woke up one morning any more than you can drive to California by just putting your foot on the pedal on the right. You have to have a plan. And then once you have a plan, then you can make progress on that plan.
That makes sense. I mean, that really goes back to the early advice anybody who ever took a writing course, even as far back as high school or middle school, received, which is, you know, build your sort of overall broad strokes framework first, your outline first, and then fill in the details as you go. But yeah, have an idea where you're going. Otherwise, you may just come around a corner and realize, wow, I totally wasted all this time. I have nowhere to go from here, right?
Yes, exactly. You know, that's a common problem that people report. Well, I don't know where to go from here. Yeah, okay, then that means that you made at least two big mistakes about 2 miles back. You have to work out most of that ahead of time. Now, not every little thing necessarily, and that has to be cautioned against too, because, you know, if you're not going to start writing until everything is perfect, then you're never going to start writing. But you really have to have a big plan. So, yeah, you know, when I am writing a book, I already know, you know, this is who's going to live and this is who's going to die. And, you know, yes, they're going to get married, or no, they're not. You know, I know this all ahead of time. Another piece of advice is that Hollywood, as usual, gets everything wrong. And Hollywood loves to show writers sitting and staring at a blank sheet of paper or a blank screen, waiting to think of something to write. Do not do this, because it's not going to write itself. I think it was Michelangelo who said, "I saw the angel in the marble, and I carved until I set him free." He had the advantage of having a block of marble. It's of a certain dimension. You know, it's 7 feet tall by 3 feet by 3 feet. You know that your statue is going to be smaller than that because you're going to cut material away. Writers don't have that advantage. You know, writers are staring into the void. So don't do that. Don't just stare at the blank sheet. Write something. You can, even if it's just notes, even if it's just ideas. The main character falls in love. Is the main character female? Yes. What's her name? I don't know. Let's say Jane Smith for right now. Where does she live? Maybe Miami. Maybe Chicago. Chicago could be cool. I mean, and you're writing useless nonsense, but you're starting to think. You're starting the process of thinking and putting words on the page. And, you know, that's going to keep you going. Then you can go back and refine what you've written. Or, instead of writing, you might go and do research. If Jane Smith is going to live in Chicago and fall in love, but then her mother will die unexpectedly, which will test her newfound relationship as she grieves, that's your basic plot, then go look at some pictures of Chicago, or go read a guidebook to Chicago, or anything, because ideas will come to you. People often say to me, where do you get your ideas? To which I say, ideas are a dime a dozen. I mean, anyone can open up the latest USA Today and see 50 ideas. You know, a company goes bankrupt because everybody in the company was a compulsive liar. Well, there's an idea right there. You know, man found dead with a stuffed taxidermied poodle and 2 kilograms of pure heroin. Well, if you can't figure out a story out of that, you know, then you're in the wrong business.
Yeah.
People say to me, how did you come up with your idea for the Berlin fraternity? I'm like, well, the basic idea of vampires is a very well-known one. Obviously, there are dozens of books and movies and so on. And then Nazis and World War II is a very dramatic piece of history. The History Channel makes their paycheck on that. You know, that's not – I didn't feel that that was terribly hard to think up. So ideas are easy. Finished work is hard. So if – you're trying to write something, don't sit and stare at a page. It's discouraging. Put something on the page, anything. You know, Jane lives in Chicago. Her mother dies unexpectedly. What is her mother like? What is her mother's backstory? Anything. Go look at pictures of Chicago. Go on Facebook and say, anybody ever been to Chicago? And see what they have to say. Sure. And this will, you know, produce ideas for you, and this will get things moving. But just sitting in a chair staring at nothing is going to achieve nothing.
Well, two things in response to that. One, I'm glad to hear that there is a balance to be struck between planning and acting. You know, you don't just want to dive in without a plan. At the same time, you don't want to plan to death.
Yes.
The second thing, I'm glad that I'm a computer programmer, and I'm glad that my profession is not the only one that's misrepresented in Hollywood. I mean, how many times is the programmer sitting down, either the programmer's defying mathematical laws by, like, you know, really gritting his teeth and squinting at the screen and breaking encryption that is unbreakable, or yes, or writing code is, you know, I don't want to say boiled down to, but rather is puffed up into being this awesome exercise in manipulating polygons that float around in the air with all kinds of neat sounds going on and skulls and crossbones flying around on the screen. You know, I'm glad that writers also watch movies and are frustrated by the fact that their profession is misrepresented by Hollywood boobs.
Absolutely. Here's something about programmers in the movies. We're afraid of them. Our culture is afraid of programmers. Miracles are brought to us daily by software and electronics and so on. I mean, we all routinely walk around with a machine in our pocket that has 100 times the computing power than the Apollo missions did. And you play Candy Crush on it, so feel bad about that. But at the same time, we're afraid of them. You know, hackers are stealing your information. So how often do we see these headlines? You know, hackers are watching your children through the baby monitor. So they're this mysterious force, and they do what they do behind closed doors. No one watches the you know, no one comes to your work and watches you do what you do. You do it, and there's a result that other people don't understand. So programmers are essentially witches in our modern culture, which is why the movies portray what they do as sorcery. You know, with a lot of sweating and squinting and hand waving and skulls and crossbones flying through the air and crazy images playing on the walls of the cave.
We just replaced them with polygons and triangles now.
Right, exactly. But it's not much different.
You know, I never really thought about it that way. But, you know, I kind of don't mind being in the new, like, sorcerer class, but I want a little bit of respect. Like, I would like to command a little respect. I would like people to be afraid of me at times, you know?
Sure.
You got to start wearing the hat.
Yeah, I think we need, like, a programmer's hat to wear around that would let people know that we mean business and we can weave the, we can weave programming code in ways that the average mortal cannot understand.
When you look at role-playing games set in modern or postmodern settings, very often the computer expert character, when you read the rules that govern their behavior, it's a lot like a magic system, which stands out especially in Shadowrun, of course, where you have both magicians and hackers and programmers.
Well, the day may come when computing is so ubiquitous that something akin to magic may exist. But we're not there yet, trust me. Programmers are just people trying to make a living for the most part.
Akin to magic. Right now, we're having a conversation where three people who have never seen each other's faces are talking simultaneously across vast distances.
Your point is taken. All right, let me flip the coin over and step away from your writing and ask you for any advice for anybody interested in doing any kind of performance work.
I have to say I don't feel qualified to give that advice. I sort of fell over backwards into this film project. As I say, what, you know, my acting experience is that I took a few classes as a kid at, like, the local arts center, and then when I was in Vero Beach, there was a amateur theater there. They put up a sign, you know, we're looking for actors, come in and try it out. They actually put up one of my plays there too, you know, and that's what I did. So I really can't say that I feel qualified to endanger anybody else's sanity by giving advice on how to be an actor.
I think you can give the time honored advice of get noticed, catch a lucky break, and fall into it. I mean, that, a lot of people's careers kind of took that path, right?
Yeah, well, quite a lot of it is lucky coincidence. I mean, luck is a matter of being prepared for opportunity. But
I like that. Say that again.
Luck is a matter of being prepared for opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I'm thoroughly prepared. I need the opportunity to come rolling my way.
Right. And, you know, very often you hear about people being overnight successes or something. which is kind of ridiculous. I mean, you take a look at James Gandolfini, you know, the actor best known for his role as Tony Soprano on the HBO series. You know, was he, what, 40 years old before he was cast in that role? And he had done a few supporting bits. I mean, maybe you recognized him from this or that. And then they decide to cast him in The Sopranos. And people say, oh, overnight, he's rocketed to fame. Well, no, this is a guy who was in the trenches, you know, busting his ass for years, going to auditions, you know, getting rejected, taking whatever part they offered him because he needed a paycheck. And then The Sopranos comes along and says, hey, how would you like to be the dad slash boss on this new HBO series? You know, but HBO would not have made that offer to him if he had not had those years of really crawling over the barbed wire. And then people could say, oh, well, how wonderful that you've suddenly had this success. And it wasn't sudden. I mean, that was years and years of hard work.
So what you're saying is, if Brian and I keep at this podcasting thing for a few years, it's only a matter of time before somebody needs two sorcerers whose magic is best suited behind a mic. I don't know.
Well, arguably, it's a little bit like encryption. It may only be a matter of time, but the time necessary might be a million years.
There you go. And, well, okay, our digital voices will be preserved for, we're hoping, eternity. So, I mean, maybe it's just some facsimile of us can be reconstructed at a future date, and that can become famous, even though we'll be dead.
Look at the nature of the internet, of course. Who knows if for some reason Gizmodo decides to reference your podcast or some of the other tech blogs whose names have totally escaped me just now. suddenly, bam, there's a 500,000 hits. Stranger things have happened. But if you're not there grinding away at the podcast, then it's not going to happen.
Boom. There you go, Nerd Travaganza, Brian. This is our moment of validation. What we're doing is preparing ourselves constantly for opportunity.
Episode 372 will be an overnight sensation.
Well, speaking of validation, though, I think it's too easy to be haunted by greatness. And people say, well, I'm not going to bother to try because I'm not going to be Steven Spielberg. Or, you know, I'm not going to be George Lucas or J.K. Rowling. And I think that's a mistake. I think that the movies are not geek culture. The bestsellers aren't geek culture. We are. And podcasts like this are the fabric of it. Independent authors and podcasts like this and, you know, every basement where the lights burn late over the polyhedrons is really where geek culture is happening. You know, we make it, they don't. And we may never be millionaires, but we had our time.
Hear, hear. I can't agree more. And I can't tell you how many times friends seem to go out of their way to actively discourage me. Like, I mean, dude, you don't have like 18,000 listeners an episode. You know, why are you even bothering? Like, if you can't be absolutely perfect, don't even bother being somewhat good or having fun, you know?
Right, which is an attitude popular among idiots.
No comment. I did mention some friends have said this. Nerd Travaganza Brian, I assume you will also stay mum on the topic.
Yeah. Some people, I don't know. I've always thought some people made it themselves and maybe didn't want to share. Like, oh, it was really hard for me. You don't have it. You know, it's too much work. Forget it.
Mm.
But yeah, it could just be an idiot too, I guess.
Well, I'm going to go with idiot.
It's very easy to criticize, but it's much more difficult to accomplish. One thing that I keep in mind as a writer is I don't need to appeal to everyone. I don't even need to appeal to remotely close to everyone. Sometimes, you know, friends or people I know might hear about the book or read some of it and decide not to finish it or not to read it at all. And then they always kind of want to play this smoke and mirrors game like, oh, yeah, no, gee, I've been busy. Hey, I don't mind if you don't like it. You know, no book in the history of books has been liked by everyone. And you can look at major, gigantic successes, you know, Harry Potter, Stephen King's work, et cetera. If those books sell 2 million copies, that's a freight train of success. But in the English-speaking world, there's something like 500,000,000 people. So in order to be a freight train of success, I only need to appeal to like one in every 2,000 people or something. So I'm well aware that it's perfectly all right if, you know, John Smith, who I meet in the street, or Maria Lopez, who I bump into at a show, isn't interested. That doesn't bother me. But another thing to keep in mind, the flip side of that is that if you do anything, if you do a podcast, if you write a book, if you make a television program, more people are going to hate you than like you. You know, if this podcast is potentially available to an audience, well, it's on the internet, so potentially it's available to an audience of hundreds of millions. But if you had 100,000 listeners, you'd be pretty excited about that number. But the fact remains that that means that 999,900,000 people couldn't care less, right? So it's quite brave to put your work forward that way for an inevitable blizzard of criticism, which obviously our modern world makes very easy to see, because any casting decision about Batman versus Superman or change of artist on a particular Marvel title instantly produces, you know, a barrage of vitriol from people who are convinced that they could do better, but have probably never even attempted anything one-tenth the size of that project in their lives. So, you know, I say do not go gentle into that good night, essentially, is my advice.
I'm with you. And you touched on one thing, and I guess if you don't mind, I'd like to step away from the personal and sort of get your perspective on a couple of things in the broader quote-unquote geek culture that we've been touching on in our past few episodes.
Sure.
You touched on something we talked about, I think, two episodes ago, where we talked about how hypercritical people in our circles can be. And you mentioned, for example, the casting in the Batman Superman movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great example to bring up. Why are people so passionately against this new Superman? And why are they so angry at this skilled actor, Ben Affleck, being cast as Batman? And why do they feel qualified to completely just dump on things? And this is a question both to you, Brian, our guest, and to Nerdtravaganza, Brian. What is it about geeks that makes them such insufferable, like, know-it-alls, man?
I don't think it's about geeks. I think that if you were to go onto websites and blogs about professional football, you'd find the same attitudes. You go onto political blogs and you'll find people spitting venom about what Representative so-and-so did or Congresswoman thus and such said. I think it's very easy for people to have opinions. There's an actual psychological phenomenon that shows that people who aren't very good at something don't realize it. People tend to overestimate their skill if they know nothing about what they're doing. So, you know, people who know nothing about baseball will cheerfully have very strong opinions about baseball. And this happens all the time. And when you're making Batman versus Superman, for example, there's any number of conditions. I mean, people have contracts, there's negotiations, there's money involved, there's schedules involved, there's this, there's that. There's a million variables they're trying to juggle that I don't think that's appreciated by, you know, a lot of these commentators who are just firing off with, well, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard, you know. But again, you have that problem where if, you know, anything you do artistically, more people aren't going to like than do like. But this movie only needs to reach a comparatively small audience. If 20 million people in the whole world go and see this movie, it'll make a bucket of money. But that's only a small percentage. I think, too, with geeks, when you're talking about Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, these characters have been around so long and are marketed to children, you know, comic books and cartoons and so on. Nobody hesitates to put their kid down in front of a Superman cartoon, that people feel a very strong sense of identity. I've been a Superman fan since I was 7. And when you make changes, you're really messing around with the furniture in their mind. You know, they have a very strong idea of who Batman is or what he should do. So that's dangerous.
Nerdtravaganza, Brian, what do you think? You think there's this sort of sense of ownership that people have such that they feel compelled almost to just crap on even the slightest what they perceive as infraction, let's say?
Yeah, my gut reaction, like my Rorschach reaction, was entitlement. And I think that is the same thing. I think people, you're right. I mean, I've loved Star Wars since, I know it wasn't my first memory, but since the first earliest memories that I can actually recall. I'm sure I did things before I was 7, but I can't really recall that. I remember being 7 years old and the friend that I went with being terrified of Yoda and having to leave the movie and how upset I was that I didn't get to see the rest of it. And then going back, you know, a week later and seeing all of it without her and all this cool stuff. I mean, I have been a fan of Star Wars my entire life. I don't want anybody to take it away. Even if they can do it better.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And that's what they're aiming for, obviously, you know, enduring characters that people will continue to imagine and to treasure. This is narrative, you know, from the beginning, from Hercules, meaning the Greek myth, not the recent film. Although the recent film obviously is just the latest version of that myth. And therefore, when you make changes, people are going to get excited. Also, I think that it's the internet tends to distort things. So a news article goes up that says we're going to be casting so-and-so as the latest crew member on the Starship Enterprise, or in the next Star Trek, Chekhov is going to die or something. And then what happens is, bam, 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 there are 200 comments saying, this is terrible, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard, these people ought to throw themselves in front of a bus. And this seems like just an absolute avalanche of anger. You know, if you had 200 people standing in front of you screaming in your face, it would be overwhelming. But it's only 200 people out of, again, the entire Star Trek watching world, which is many millions of people large. So really, it's a minority. It's a tiny, tiny minority. But when you're scrolling through it, it seems huge. And it's important to keep perspective on that, that 200 people screaming and yelling is just 200 people. And you can't please all the people all the time.
Or as we put it in that episode, you can't please most of the people most of the time.
That's, yes, also true. And again, they don't have to. If 20 million people buy a ticket for the movie, then the movie makes a pile of money. And 10 million of them might not like it. But still, the movie has succeeded. And, you know, I have to admire anyone who can produce a piece of art that touches 10 million people who are going to come out of that saying that was terrific.
No kidding.
As a writer, I aspire to a place where 17-year-olds in study hall are threatening to kill me via email because I did something with one of their favorite characters that they object to. I mean, that'll be a happy day in my career.
I'm still fixated on the 100,000 listener figure you threw out there like a few minutes ago. Man, that would be like a dream come true.
Yeah, well, sure. Absolutely. But however, I mean, how many listeners do you have? Do you know? I don't know if you have the metrics to be measuring that.
Oh, yeah. You know, we're closing on that 100,000 mark. 95 to 8,000 short of that, but we're getting close, man. We're getting close.
Right, you're closer to 100,000 a day than you were yesterday.
Okay, you know what? If you put it that way, we started with like single digits of listeners per episode, then we got into tens, and now Nerd Extravaganza, Brian, keep me honest. I think we're in the hundreds of listeners per episode, right?
Yeah. We average. I'm not sure they're all unique, but yeah, we definitely get.
Well, that's growing. And let me say this. First of all, the technology is changing. The new book I'm writing, Red Sleeper, is set in the 1950s. So I've been doing research about that period. And television was then what the internet is now. But there were only like three or four channels. So the Milton Berle show was a huge hit. Gunsmoke, the Western, was a huge hit, which meant that because there were only three television channels, literally like 40% of the country saw any given episode of Milton Berle. You know, if you went down the street you lived on the next day, you could count on almost half the people in your neighborhood having seen it and wanting to talk about it. And it was this very communal experience that way. But the technology was such that the television broadcast was tremendously expensive to produce and to reach out to an audience. And the only way to do it was literally a broadcast. So you're just blasting the broadcast waves across the landscape and hoping to reach somebody who's interested. Today, obviously, we have the internet, we have YouTube channels and so on, where you can get to a more and more specific audience on a smaller and smaller budget. I mean, podcasting, obviously, you know, you guys potentially, anyone on the planet could listen to you. Anybody in Tokyo or Hanoi who can type Nerd Extravaganza into a search bar can be listening to you in a matter of seconds. That kind of reach is unprecedented in human history. That kind of reach would have cost hundreds of millions of dollars 50 years ago.
We do have a French listener, which has always kind of boggled me.
Well, and that's great. But the thing about that is that the if you can find your audience, and it doesn't have to be a huge audience. Media gets obsessed with this idea of gigantic audiences. But if you guys could reach the right 10,000 people, then it's worth doing. You just have to reach the right audience.
Agreed. And now that I know that we've reached France, I mean, we're halfway around the world. So we're reaching a global audience already.
Yeah, you're going to be huge in Poland.
Oh, man. Well, this has been an encouraging episode. A little self-serving, I feel. Was there anything, Brian, that we didn't discuss that you wanted to bring up?
Well, my rugged good looks and natural charm.
Obviously.
Got short shrift. But, you know, I understand that we have time constraints, so we don't have to push that.
We can obviously post tasteful nudes on our website, so just send those over to us. We'll be glad to put those out there for your admirers.
Yes, absolutely. And that, I'll do that. I think I'm going to wait for this, Jennifer Lawrence thing to die down a little bit. I don't want to seem to be in bad taste so soon, but yeah, you know.
Yeah, the nude space is a little crowded right now, so I would wait until eyes were off of those photos. Yeah, okay, we can time that for later. We'll monitor the news feeds to see when that all dies down.
That is one thing about this, by the way, astonishing to me, that on an internet that is 80% cats and 18% pornography, how is it that a few more nudes causes so much fuss?
Well, not to get political or anything, but I think a sort of gender identity spin has been put on that story. She is now a victim of a new form of sexual assault called leaking nude photos. Am I wrong about that, Nurtravaganza, Brian?
I had not heard that. Oh, I wouldn't doubt it.
No, certainly I understand there are elements of, political elements and a feminist issue, and it's terrible and ridiculous. I don't know what would motivate a person to steal such photos and make them public against Ms. Lawrence's will. It's like, is there you're getting a prize for being a jerk off here? I don't know. But it's been a lot of controversy and excitement about it, certainly.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. I mean, I think a lot of times these things are motivated by maybe a personal vendetta someone has, but it sounds like hackers of some sort, magicians, somehow got into some online storage she had or something and got her photos that way. At least that's what I read. So
yeah, it's certainly terrible. I know the FBI is pursuing the matter now, and I hope they catch them.
Yeah, I do too. That's pretty messed up. And you know, we've got plenty of willing people who will put their nude photos out there. Our guests sign a contract.
Yes.
Mandating the display of nude photos. So, there's no need to steal and put compromising photos of people out there on the internet when the Nerdtravaganza podcast provides a limitless supply of such photos.
Yeah, I wonder how actual porn performers have to feel about this. Where like, I'm working hard to provide totally consensual pictures of me naked and doing all sorts of things, but I get blown off the headlines by this Jennifer Lawrence thing.
Right. Not only will you, like, I'm good at nude photos. Like, it's my job. And this woman didn't even want hers out there.
Yeah. But I do hope they catch those guys. I don't know what would motivate such just shabby behavior.
Yeah. Who knows? People are jerks.
This is true.
Present company excluded, however.
Yes. Not us. Other people.
If I can harken back to a old television show that taught me a lot about being a human, Charles from Charles in Charge tackled an issue similar to this once, and the result was, even though I've seen one, I still want to see them all.
Mm-hmm.
I think that might be your motivation.
So it's just a crime of opportunity, basically.
That's all I have.
I should probably review the Charles in Charge body of work.
It made me what I am today. Well, partially.
Charles in Charge, one of the many influential sitcoms of the 1980s. And no better a topic that I could think of to end the podcast with than Charles in Charge. Do you think, Nurtravaganza, Brian, that we could get a royalty-free clip of Charles in Charge, the theme song, to play at the end of this episode?
That might be Abandonware by now.
Oh, nice. Abandonware. Let's do it then.
Yeah, I don't think there's a team of lawyers sharpening their knives to defend the legacy of Charles in Charge from, you know, podcasters right now.
Awesome. Well, with that said, I think, Brian, we are going to put you back in charge of your night.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me on the podcast, guys. It's been a great time.
Thanks for coming on and best of luck in the writing world, man. I'm always impressed. I tried to be a writer for a while, and people who make it happen just blow me away.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Thank you. I'm glad to hear it.
And remember, when you're on stage, the tip I always heard was to picture yourself naked, or to picture the audience naked. Somebody's supposed to be naked, and it's not Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah, no. I think it's the audience, and I'll do that. I'll imagine all those YouTube viewers at home in their underwear watching the movie.
Try both. Whatever works better, man.
I'll experiment. I'll experiment.
You do that. Anyway, man, thanks for being on. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we will hopefully have you on again in the future, man.
All right, great.
See ya.
Good night.
Good night.
Okay, that concludes our interview with Brian Downs. I thought it was a cool interview. I think he's a cool guy. He's got a lot going on. Seems like every time we have a guest on, Brian, I feel compelled to do more with my life.
I suppose it's perspective, because we don't have an outsider's understanding of what it is to have an episode 100 and what is this, 119 of our podcast.
Yeah.
That's fairly productive.
Yeah, you know, I guess that's the case. You always take what you have accomplished for granted and, like, just consider it, like, part of a normal, mundane life. But, I mean, we have kind of done something with the podcast, I suppose, right?
A little bit. Hopefully there's more.
Well, yeah, let's hope there's a few more years worth. But, man, I really feel like I need to put out some kind of product. Apart from this, this is sort of a product in and of itself, but writers just never cease to inspire me, man. The fact that you're able to sit down and just have the belief in yourself that all of this that you're going to pour out on the page is going to be read by somebody and valued, that just takes some brass balls, in my opinion.
I'm contemplating that. I don't really know what to say. Yeah, it does make sense that's a little on the brave side. But from my own experience, again, trying so far unsuccessfully to, you know, claim the writer title, it's such a removed thing, because I don't think you feel brave watching people and remembering what they do so that you can write it later. It's very much an outsider.
Oh, you mean because you mean from our perspective, it is an undertaking of a different magnitude than we perceive, or what is it you're saying exactly?
I'm saying that I think someone who is a writer may not consider themselves brave. They may feel like removed or not a participant, an observer.
Oh, I see.
Again, just perspective. You saying they're brave is kind of new to me, actually.
Ah, interesting. Oh, so you as a writer, you don't see the inherent bravery that I seem to.
I mean, now that you mention it, but no, it had to be pointed out.
But then again, there may be people saying, like, it takes some balls to actually try to do a podcast, considering that, you know, nobody's going to listen, and all your friends will say you suck, and blah, 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 all of which is true.
God knows we sounded like idiots for a year.
It's the truth, but you know what, at a certain point, and talking to Brian really reminded me of this, he kind of hit on this a couple of times. So what, you have detractors? So what, you don't get rich? So what? You're, what did he say, haunted by perfection. Just do your best. Get it out there and say you've done it. It's better than spending your whole life, you know, dreaming of something and never doing it and then dropping dead, never having tried anything in life, you know?
I think the big question for me is, what else were you doing with your Tuesdays?
That's a really good way to put it.
It's an hour less gaming I get done. Oh, no.
You know what? And thinking back to the early days of our podcast, like the first couple episodes, like, man, are we going to really do with this? As Brian mentioned, you know, you write one chapter at a time. Well, so it is with this. We do one episode at a time. And if we want to embark on other endeavors, you have sort of a idea where you're going, but you tackle it piece by piece. And he made a perfect analogy to university study. And I think maybe you'll agree. When I was in school, I didn't think about what I was going to be taking next year. It was about getting through this class this semester. And man, that's really a very healthy approach to life. Be mindful of where you're going, but don't be so fixated on the distant horizon that you're not looking at what's right in front of you.
Didn't Obi-Wan say that?
He probably should have if he didn't. No, he just said, I have a bad feeling about this, I think.
No. You know what? It was Obi-Wan asking Qui-Gon, be mindful of the future, young Padawan, but remain in the present.
Oh, yeah. Be look to the future, but be mindful of the present, too. Yeah. He was right. Writing, I could see myself doing. But acting? My hat's off to Brian on that, man. I don't think I could get up on a stage and subject myself to the gaze of so many people. Or you know, even if he, like, for example, he's doing film, like, that camera is, like, recording everything you do and you have to pretend it's not there. I don't know if I could do that.
I've never tried, but I have heard that it's not you. So it's easier. It's not me, it's Dr. Copernicus. So what do I care if Dr. Copernicus looks stupid?
Oh, you put on this mask, you are this character, it is not you.
Right.
Huh. Yeah, you know, I'm good at doing make-believe, so if as long as it's make-believe, if you want to record me playing make-believe, maybe I could do it. I'm going to have to call him up and see if I can get a part in that movie. Oh, anything else to discuss? I want to mention one more time that I thought that the historical setting for his novel was pretty cool. I seriously was expecting to learn that he was a student of history.
I have a slightly different interest in it. I read his treatment first, and it was, you know, German in World War I and Nazis in World War II. And I really thought it was going to, you know, the Nazis were going to be the bad guys. And to see his characters, like, kind of chat with what we've always considered to be, like, the evil assholes of the universe was different. I mean, I don't think he was glorifying them in any way, but, you know, some of them were just following orders. Some of them were human beings. And I kind of liked seeing that.
Yeah, you know, humanizing Nazis in any way is always risky because they're so easy to view as non-human. But man, it was interesting. I had to actually, like, consider that the characters were talking to these, like, infamous historical figures. And, like, I pondered that. And as well, I went off and did research about the setting. Like, just a really cool idea, the entire concept behind the novel.
Yeah.
The sequel, he hit on it in the title, but and I think he even mentioned as much. It's a Soviet setting, right?
Yes.
Yeah, cool. I'm looking forward to it. I call it a sequel, but he said it's another novel set in the same universe, not necessarily a sequel.
Right, kind of serialized, I think. That's the way to do it these days.
Yeah, it should be cool. Either way, you're looking at sort of a similar setting set against a totalitarian background. Looking forward to it, man. So anything else, or should we call it quits on this episode?
I think we're ready to wrap this one.
All right. Well, folks, tell you what, if you like cereals, you should consider our cereal podcast. Every week, we pour you a big bowl of entertainment and cover it in milky goodness. You can check out our milk-sodden podcast every week by subscribing to us on iTunes or whatever other podcatching software you happen to use. And if you do so, we really would appreciate it if you would write us a favorable review and rate us a maximum number of stars. And if podcatching is not your thing and you're more into streaming, can't recommend enough that you check us out on Stitcher.
Also, cannot recommend enough that you like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, plus one us on Google+, and join the Nerdstravaganza HQ group on Facebook.
And if that's not enough, you can correspond with us directly by dropping us a line at nerdstravaganza@gmail.com. And of course, we invite you to check out our, I guess it's a novel of sorts, our very own handwritten website, nerdstravaganza.com. And until next time, remember, you are the author of your future.